Welcome to OnkLive On Air. I'm your host today, Aisling Wehner. OnkLive On Air is a podcast from OnkLive, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, OnkLive covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, sponsored by Taiho Pharmaceutical, John H. Strickler, MD, moderated an OnkLive Inside the Clinic discussion about adverse effect management for patients with colorectal cancer. Strickler is an associate professor of medicine and a member of the Duke Cancer Institute in Durham, North Carolina. Strickler was joined by Michael Leung, PharmD, BCOP, a clinical pharmacy specialist in gastrointestinal medical oncology at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Arvind N. Dasari, MD, MS, an associate professor in the Department of GI Medical Oncology in the Division of Cancer Medicine at MD Anderson, and Margot O'Neill, PAC, MHS, a physician assistant in oncology at the Duke Cancer Institute. In our exclusive interview, the panelists discussed adverse effect monitoring and management with trifluridine tipiracil plus bevacizumab for patients with previously treated metastatic colorectal cancer, prophylactic and reactive adverse effect management strategies when using regorafenib for patients with advanced disease, and how real-world clinical experience with fruquintinib has driven adverse effect management for patients with metastatic disease who are receiving this agent.
Arvind, what's your general approach to third-line treatment of colorectal cancer with TAS-102 and bevacizumab? How are you monitoring the patients with this regimen? And do you do any proactive counseling for these patients?
I'll start off, and I would like to invite Mike to provide his input as well, because it's truly a partnership between the team comprising of the oncologists, pharmacists, nurses, PAs, and the patient. And in fact, Mike's group recently published a wonderful article kind of highlighting kind of proactive monitoring by the pharmacy team, where they reach out to patients over phone calls after they start the treatment. That was really exciting. So with regards to kind of my perspective, firstly, the dosing of TAS-102 is somewhat tricky, right? It's days 1 through 5 and 8 through 12, so hard to keep that straight. So I typically tell patients that the easiest way to remember it is Monday through Friday for 2 weeks and off for the other 2 weeks for the rest of the month. And then you come in for bevacizumab infusion twice a month. With regards to what to watch out for, the two main side effects to watch out for would be myelosuppression. That includes neutropenia and thrombocytopenia. Thankfully, very rarely are these severe enough to cause major issues such as afebrile neutropenia or bleeding, but nevertheless, something to caution the patient about. And then in addition, since we also have bevacizumab on board, the typical conversation around the potential adverse effects of bevacizumab, including hypertension, which tends to be the most common adverse effect that we need to watch out for. Also, some rarer side effects, such as thromboembolic phenomenon and so on.
You know, so much of capturing the benefit of these therapies is patient selection. And, you know, it's important to know that the data we have for the TAS-102 bevacizumab combination is quite impressive. We're seeing a progression-free survival improvement from, you know, 2 months or less with TAS-102 by itself to 4 months or better with the TAS-102 bevacizumab combination. And I think that's very attractive to us when we look at the clinical trial evidence. But, you know, remembering that clinical trials have enrollment criteria and there are issues that can come up, and not everybody would have qualified for that trial, right? That we would consider a candidate for this. So we do have to be careful that our patient selection is appropriate to the therapy, that we take into consideration maybe the degree to which prior myelosuppressive chemotherapy might impair their ability to handle the drugs. And Mike, what is your general counseling that you give patients? How do we proactively manage this? Do we tell the patient what to look out for, or do we maybe make dose reductions up front? How's our general approach around dosing and counseling to the patient?
That's a great question. It can be very complex with TAS-102 and bevacizumab together. As far as dosing and dose reductions empirically go, I think for the most part, we take a look at the general patient on their own and how they've tolerated therapy in the past. If they've had prior issues with myelosuppression on their intravenous chemotherapy regimens, and that helps inform some of our decision as to whether we go with the standard dose of TAS-102 or if we maybe make some minor adjustments. One of the interesting parts about TAS-102 in terms of the dosage forms is that there are two dosage forms, a 15 milligram and a 20 milligram. And so at our practice here, we tend to try to focus on only dispensing one dosage form for a patient, as when you have two dosage forms, you know, there's extra co-pays and out-of-pocket costs for patients. And so, if a patient tends to fall between two different dosage forms, in terms of their total dose calculated out, we tend to try to account for their prior adverse events in prior regimens and determine whether we want to be a little bit more aggressive on the dosing or if we want to be a little bit more conservative and err on the side of caution a little bit more. As far as things like the adverse events go, a lot of it is just informing patients of what to look out for. You know, oftentimes they'll say, hey, I've never really encountered issues with infectious complications or a lot of low platelet counts in prior regimens. And so we tell them, hey, this is something that we have seen more frequently with this particular regimen. And so it is just something that we want to reiterate, even though you've probably heard this two or three or four more times with your prior counseling sessions with treatment. And so that is an important point to drive home with them as far as the counseling goes.
I think that's so critical. Margo, one of the challenges we have is whenever there's a new FDA-approved therapy based on impressive evidence, we read the papers, we hear the presentations, and then sometimes when we bring the therapies into the clinic, we say, wow, we weren't expecting, you know, that adverse event profile, and there can be kind of a real-world experience with that. So with the TAS-102 bevacizumab experience, how have you kind of adjusted how you look at that regimen? And when you bring it into a real-world setting with real-world patients who maybe wouldn't have qualified for Sunlight trial or some of the other trials.
Exactly. We've talked quite a bit about the cytopenias, neutropenia, and how to manage those. Our practice typically has been to focus on dose reductions and on a very rare occasion, a schedule change in the TAS-102. We tend to not use growth factor at all. Well, what I find to be a bigger AE is the fatigue. And what can be really difficult for these patients is how heavily pretreated they are and perhaps their other comorbidities and where they may be in their disease course. And it can be very difficult, especially in the first cycle, to differentiate fatigue related to their disease progression versus drug.
It sounds like your preferred approach, which is my practice as well, be interested in the MD Anderson experience, is to really be careful about that fatigue and make dose reductions to make it manageable. Is there a time, do you tell that patient this is going to be the worst time for the fatigue? Do you give them a upfront heads up on, hey, this is a 4-week cycle, look out for fatigue this particular week?
I would say that would be my counseling for our patients for sure.
Mike and Arvin, when do you think the fatigue peaks for that TAS-102 bevacizumab regimen?
From what we've seen in the patients that we've started on these treatments over the years, I would say typically around that third week, when they're off treatment, they've taken about, 10 days worth of therapy, sometimes on the higher end of dosing. And that really seems to get to them a little bit more. We do see it a little bit more now, or at least we're hearing more reports about it now, in part, I think, because we're seeing these patients back on day 15 in clinic oftentimes for their bevacizumab infusions. And so they have that more opportune time to just say, hey, I'm having a lot of difficulty with this. You know, I don't know if I want to do another infusion of the bevacizumab. And then that's where our opportunity to talk to them and say, hey, you know, this is a little bit more of the oral cancer treatment that you've been taking. And while it's not the most tolerable right now, it will get a little bit better. And it's not going to be worsened with this upcoming infusion that you're getting today.
Mike, you're obviously a key member of this multidisciplinary team, but tell us how that works. Who's involved in this and the counseling, and hearing the triage calls. How is that handled at your institution?
Yeah, we have a great team here at MD Anderson. Everybody plays a really important role in creating that team dynamic for us. Each person leverages their own strengths. And so, of course, we have our providers here, our physicians, our physician assistants, our nurse practitioners. Each of them are essentially the continuity and driving force of our clinic team. And they have to be the ones, as you all know, that make decisions on how to manage patients and select therapy and managing the adverse events. You're all often very involved in making those risk management analyses on the fly as patients come in to help make sure that they feel comfortable about any of the care decisions that are made on their behalf. For our nurses, we have wonderful nurses here at our clinic, about our teams here, and they're generally our frontline liaisons between the patients and the rest of the clinic team. And they've been pretty good about communicating all the vital information from each party back and forth and helping to triage those concerns from our patients, whether it's, before they're seen by our providers in clinic or in terms of answering phone calls or messages from the patients. And as our nurses have actually increased their familiarity with the treatments that we're doing, particularly with adverse events, with, these third line therapies, they've increase their ability and capacity to ask very guided and focused questions when they're seeing these patients and when they're talking to them, so that we can have a little bit more information when we're making decisions on how to manage the adverse events. In a lot of community settings, I know the nurses are involved in doing the education and the counseling, as well as a lot of the providers in clinic. One of the things that I really love about our practice here at MD Anderson is that we have clinical pharmacists on many of our teams throughout the week. In my role, I try to speak with as many patients as I can in the clinics that I'm working with to go over some of the details of starting treatments with TAS-102 and bevacizumab. As we've previously mentioned, the schedule can be very complex with the oral administration and with the IV administration. So, we've created some tools for patients in terms of setting up calendars and customizing it to when they're supposed to take treatments, ensuring that they know that this is a twice daily oral medication for the TAS-102, and then helping them, update any reimbursement issues that can come up, as you've mentioned previously, since there are some issues with insurance that can come up with these therapies. Everybody plays a huge role in managing the adverse events and in counseling and making sure that, we're all understanding of what could be more of the cancer-related symptoms and what could be a little bit more of the treatment-related adverse events.
Yeah, I like to say that I'm only as good as the people around me. And we have, really a large multidisciplinary team at most places to manage patients. Advanced colorectal cancer is a difficult disease. It has a lot of symptoms. The therapies have adverse events that need to be carefully monitored. There's a lot of education involved, and I think the optimal team really does include pharmacists, our advanced practitioners, like our nurse practitioners and PAs, our nurses, who oftentimes will be the first point of contact when the patient is not doing well. Our pharmacists are so critical to all of these aspects of patient advocacy, patient education, also to access, right, to the therapies. Without any of those parts of the puzzle working well, things will break down. So we're very appreciative of our multidisciplinary team. Mike, what are the common adverse events that you're counseling patients about with the use of regorafenib? And are there any things you're doing in terms of prophylaxis, or are you more reactive with some of these adverse events?
A lot of what we've discussed already are things that we see fairly commonly in the clinical setting. So, things like more common to see fatigue and even more severe fatigue, the hand-foot skin reactions, diarrhea, liver abnormalities, typically from laboratory testing, as well as we mentioned, the increased blood pressure. Those tend to be fairly common. These are all things that we try to educate patients as much as possible. My general approach is always to try to be proactive as much as possible. First, to inform the patients as far as what could happen and what are some of the likely adverse events that they can expect from treatment. The other thing is also to remind them, hey, we're going to be doing lab work frequently. We're going to be checking in. We're going to have our nurses, PAs, physicians, pharmacists. Everyone's going to be making a concerted effort to check in with you to see when you started and ensure where in each cycle you are as far as when certain side effects may come up. I think what we've seen is certain side effects like the hand-foot skin reactions, the fatigue, hypertension, some of these peak during that first cycle, and they can see it fairly early on in the treatment course. Oftentimes, these can lead to either treatment discontinuations or dose reductions early on. So the more proactive we are with our patients to educate them and provide them with the tools to manage them at home, the longer we're able to maintain these patients on these therapeutic doses on treatment. As far as specific recommendations, you know, one thing we fairly commonly see with a lot of these multi-targeted tyrosine kinase inhibitors relate to this hand-foot skin reaction, where initially they may have lots of dryness on their skin. They start to have some redness and tenderness as it gets more severe. And in even more of the more severe presentations, they have a lot of sensitivity and these calluses that form on these weight bearing areas on their hands and on their feet. So educating them for use of topical creams like urea-based creams or salicylic acid-based creams, that's an essential part of our counseling, ensuring that they know where they can get these medications. Typically, they're all available over the counter. And so it's identifying certain brands that they may be familiar with when they walk up and down the counter and making sure that they know that they can talk with the pharmacist behind the counter to find some of these products. And as far as, you know, things like fatigue, you know, unfortunately, we don't have so much to do from a medication perspective. We don't typically prescribe medications to alleviate some of the fatigue that patients see with this therapy. So a lot of it is trying to encourage patients to try to stay active, to try to move around, not to overexert themselves, but to ensure that they're maintaining an active lifestyle as much as they can, that they're trying to maintain a normal diet. Those are some of the things that we can see. And of course, you know, trying to rule out other causes of fatigue from these patients. As Margo had mentioned previously with TAS-102 and bevacizumab, we're not always sure if these are things that are related to the treatment that we've selected, or if they can be other causes like anemia of chronic disease from the cancer, or even things like hypothyroidism. So we want to make sure we look at some of those causes as well.
Yeah, and certainly there's some of these side effects are challenging to manage. I think Margo had mentioned earlier that the fatigue sometimes can be the toughest one to manage. And outside of a dose reduction, which is, I think, what we eventually do in most cases when people are struggling with fatigue, there have been reports in the literature of weight-bearing exercises potentially combating the fatigue because there's some muscle wasting that goes on with an anti-VEGF tyrosine kinase inhibitor. I think many of us in our clinic here at our institution are relying on skin moisturizers for the hand-foot skin reaction, as well as urea cream is something that we use quite a bit where that hand-foot skin reaction is involved. Any other really effective topicals that you've tried with respect to hand-foot skin reaction, Mike or Arvind?
I was really intrigued by the data that was presented at ASCO looking at diclofenac topical application and prophylactic use for hand-foot syndrome. So that's something that I've used in addition as well.
Have you had good results with that?
Still very much anecdotal, but yes, it seems to be pretty effective.
Mike, any other comments on that?
I think that's a great choice as well. A lot of the times with the hand-foot skin reactions, patients do have a lot of pain from that. So, you know, using some topical NSAIDs certainly does help with some patients that are on regorafenib. Mentioning your point earlier about, you know, using this redose strategy, it's nice because, you know, at these lower doses, we do see a lot of these side effects much less frequently. And it's not until we escalate the dose that we start to see this a little bit more.
Yeah, I think sometimes patients feel like if there's no pain, there's no gain with these therapies. And I do counsel patients that actually you don't have to suffer to benefit. Especially with a multi-targeted kinase inhibitor like regorafenib, you actually want to find a sustainable dose. And that seems to give you the best tolerability and the best impact on that cancer. So I really do try to educate folks that suffering is not necessarily what you're going for. And I think that's something that can be difficult to drive home. Now, Margo this message needs to come from multiple people on the team, not just the physician. So who are the members of the multidisciplinary team involved in the care of regorafenib, and you know, how does that ongoing education occur?
It continues to be an entire team effort between the primary clinic nurse, the triage nurses, and our pharmacist as well. All are involved in helping patients understand what to expect and how to manage the possible side effects. And then obviously the providers, the MD, the APPs, having a planned schedule for how to follow up with the patient. Typically, we plan for weekly visits, whether that be in person or usually at this point, we can engage telehealth, which can be a great way to stay in touch with these patients in the first cycle, especially as we may be adjusting the dose. I think it's also important, though, especially as we may be beginning to see the patients less frequently in person in clinic, to also remember the other multidisciplinary efforts that may be beneficial, such as still having a dietitian engaged, considering physical therapy, and then perhaps even we offer cancer patient support programs for counseling, et cetera, because as we are moving further down the lines of treatment, there's still room for improving their quality of life, but also starting to think about their goals of care.
Especially with an oral therapy, it's so easy for patients to slip through the cracks in a very busy, hardworking system. How do we ensure that patients don't slip through the cracks and that we're keeping up on these adverse events?
Absolutely. There needs to be an outlined plan, and we also need to engage the patient and the caregiver in that as well. Patients don't need to suffer. We often won't hear from the families because they just assume that it's normal, but we need to engage the entire caregiving network to stay in touch with us and always check in with us so that we can help determine what's acceptable, what's normal, what's not.
You know, I think as we think about our therapies in the clinic, we need to be so mindful of the adverse event profile, the risks, the benefits of these therapies. And when the patient and their family are part of that process and part of the education and active participants, I think these patients get the best outcomes. Margot, I know that fruquintinib is new to us in the clinic. It's just approved in November of this past year. So we haven't had a tremendous amount of what I call real-world experience with this drug yet. But in the times that it has come up, and maybe you've started a couple of patients on this, what's your monitoring strategy with this regimen? Do you do anything special with this particular drug?
So far, our plan has been to get labs at home every 7 to 10 days, consider telehealth at 14 days, and then see them back at 28 days before the next cycle. We do a lot of the same counseling with patients that we typically would with any regimen, but also I add on making sure they have access to blood pressure monitor at home. So they can be part of watching for that change, as opposed to in other settings, I might just say, if you feel bad, you know, check your blood sugar, check your blood pressure. But in this setting, I may ask a patient to just once a day keep a log of a blood pressure, just so we can be aware early of any changes. And then also the normal recommendations that I share with patients over and over again, the importance of nutrition, hydration, purposeful exercise, and then reaching out to us with any change that they're noticing so that we can keep track of the impact and severity and decide whether to make any adjustments.
Yeah, certainly until Arvin presented that data at ESMO, and that was the first I had really seen of this drug, and outside of the data from Fresco-1, which was done in China, I think the challenge with Fresco-1 was that the Chinese practice patterns are a little different from, say, those practice patterns in North America. Specifically, many of those patients on that initial study had not received prior bevacizumab. And so my eyes, whenever I'm looking at a new therapy in the clinic, is that adverse event table. What are the top three adverse events to expect? One of the things that stuck out to me with fruquintinib is hypertension seems to be more prominent with this drug. What are the adverse events that you're most mindful of since you have tremendous experience with this? Are there specific things specific to this drug that providers and patients should know about?
Overall, it seems to be well tolerated. Some patients may require dose interruptions, occasionally dose reductions. In addition to hypertension, when you look at the most common side effects that were noted on the trial, the second one is asthenia, and that was noted in about 7 to 8% of patients that was grade 3 or higher. Now, to highlight what we've discussed, that some of these side effects are not just related to therapy, but also the fact that these patients have very advanced malignancies and have received multiple therapies previously, the incidence of grade 3 or higher asthenia in the placebo arm was around 4%. So likely a good proportion of this was being driven by the disease itself. Other side effects such as diarrhea and fatigue, elevated LFTs, Hanford syndrome are all around 6% or less, that is grade 3 or higher. So I would say hypertension and asthenia, given that these patients have very advanced malignancies, would be the two main ones to watch out for. And occasionally, we do have patients who may have these more serious side effects that Mike rightly kind of very nicely outlined. So we do need to keep an eye out for the other side effects as well.
And Mike, pivoting from the data from Fresco 2 to the real world practice environment, are there any adverse events that you maybe see more in the real world setting that we need to be mindful of with fruquintinib? And what are you advising patients with regard to prophylaxis and management?
As far as the patients who have started on fruquintinib, the large majority of them seem to tolerate the medication fairly well. Even comparing the clinical trial data and anecdotally what we've seen in the few patients that we've started over these last couple of months compared to regorafenib, at least, you know, there's a lot less fatigue that we're seeing. You know, those dose-limiting toxicities of hand-foot skin reactions from regorafenib are not significantly seen with fruquintinib. It's a lot less common with this drug. Same thing for diarrhea. And of course, with hypertension being a very selective VEGF inhibitor, you are going to see them a lot more frequently. You know, but there are very clear guidelines as far as how to manage them. And so, you know, it's very similar to what we do with all the other drugs that we've talked about today, which is thorough counseling and advising them of how to manage a lot of these prophylactically, rather than, you know, waiting for them to come back to clinic 2 weeks or 4 weeks after we've started them on treatment. Because there's less cases of the fatigue and the hand-foot skin reactions, you know, we still counsel them, but we let them know, hey, there are going to be fewer issues with this, but anything that you may have done with other therapies, you know, you'll continue to that with this. And then as far as other general education points that I usually like to remind patients, you know, as a pharmacist, the things that I really try to focus on are, you know, how to take the medication and the ease and convenience that fruquintinib affords that some of the other medications may not necessarily afford, which is at the starting doses, a single tablet once daily and a fairly straightforward dosing strategy, which is 21 days in a row and 7 days off, which is fairly different than what you see with TAS-102 with and even multiple tablets and titrations with regorafenib. The other thing I also wanted to highlight is with fruquintinib, you know, it can be taken with or without food. There's really no distinction that's made. Whereas with both TAS-102 and regorafenib, you do have a little bit more guidance on how it should be appropriately taken for optimal adverse events and absorption of the drug themselves. Fruquintinib tends to be a little bit easier from that perspective of the counseling with patients, which our pharmacists do a lot of at the initiation of therapy.
Both fruquintinib and regorafenib are oral tyrosine kinase inhibitors that target VEGF. And my question for you, Mike, is how does the toxicity profile differ between fruquintinib and regorafenib? Are these the same drugs, just different names? Or tell us about how you can expect differences between them.
That's a great question, right? We very colloquially refer to them as, you know, VEGF inhibitors that are oral agents in the third line setting, but they are very different, right? So regorafenib has that multi-targeted activity, you know, that includes VEGF, it includes, you know, PDGFR, FGFR, c-KIT, all these different targets that lend a lot of different adverse events from those pathways that are inhibited. And so that's where you see a lot more of that hand, foot, skin reactions, the mucosal inflammation, mucositis, diarrhea, fatigue. You see a lot more of that with regorafenib than you do typically with fruquintinib, which is, again, very selective for VEGF 1 through 3.
How do these drugs compare in terms of real-world experience?
Yeah, I could not have kind of summarized it better. I completely agree. While we don't know why these drugs seem to be different, for instance, in the subgroup analysis from FRESCO 2, even in patients who had received regorafenib, fruquintinib seemed to be active. And as Mike outlined, perhaps this could be related to the mechanism of action where VEGF receptors 1 through 3 are very highly selectively and potently inhibited by fruquintinib versus regorafenib, where it tends to be a more broader spectrum of activity that perhaps not as deep. That's a potential explanation, but as you know, it's hard to tease out these things for these VEGF inhibitors, given that we don't have good kind of models to study them.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of Enclave On Air, sponsored by Taiho Pharmaceutical. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.enclave.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. Enclave is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at Enclave. On Facebook, like us at Enclave, and follow our Enclave page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of Enclave On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to Enclave On Air.